As you go through life, there are some fairly significant events that you face, milestones, big things that you will come across in your life. Two of them are represented in the two pictures up there on the screen. Marriage and the death of those who are close to us. They're probably two of the biggest decisions and biggest events that you will have to face in your life. They're life changers, aren't they, both of those things? They change our lives permanently. They change our lives forever. And how you approach those two events, well, it's going to reflect a lot about what you believe, about what it is that you believe about the world that we're living in. It's going to reveal a lot about your faith. I have worked as a Presbyterian minister now for around 25 years and done quite a number of funerals and a number of weddings. And I can really tell you that there's an enormous difference between them all. And they do really show what you believe about this life and about the life to come. Well, today we're finishing off looking at the story of Abraham in the book of Genesis, those closing few chapters. And we see Abraham facing three milestone events. The first one is the death of his wife Sarah. The second one is trying to find a wife for his son Isaac. And then finally we see Abram not so much organising his own funeral, but certainly dealing with his last will and testament, looking at how it is that he is approaching his death. And what we see in the decisions that Abraham makes is that his faith is revealed. We see what it is that he believes. We see that Abraham has grown in his faith as we look through these few chapters. Now, even in these events that in some ways are fairly basic events in life, they show Abraham's trust. Now, it would be very easy to skip over these last few chapters and think that they're just kind of tacked on to the end of the Abraham story, you know, the Abraham and Isaac and the sacrifice on the mountain, that was kind of the pinnacle event. So it would be easy to think that this is just kind of tying up the loose ends, you know, just a couple of little stories to finish off the Abraham narrative. But this is far more than that. These events are recorded because they show us that Abraham has learned to trust God. And he trusts God even with the most basic decisions that he makes in his life. These chapters show us that in the end, Abraham's making his decisions in life based on his faith. And here's the challenge for us. Do you trust what God has promised you? And do you shape your life, do you make your decisions based on what God has promised you? Well, the first thing's there right at the beginning of chapter 23. And we're told, I think rather abruptly, that Sarah has died. Verse 1. Sarah lived to be 127 years old. She died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abram went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her. Sarah and Abraham have now been travelling for 62 years in Canaan. These guys really are the original grey nomads. They've spent 62 years wandering around in the land of Canaan. They still don't own any land. They have one son, Isaac, who is now 37 years old and unmarried and still living at home with his parents, apparently, which seems as though some things never change. Now, we're told that he mourned the death of his wife and he's wept over her. But the death of Sarah has presented them with a very strange irony, hasn't it? After more than 60 years, they've been waiting for God to fulfil the promises about giving them the land. That's what God said 62 years ago. He said to Abram, "The whole land of Canaan, I am giving it to you." And now, at the death of Sarah, they don't even own enough to be able to bury her. They don't even own a piece of ground big enough to put in a coffin. Back then it wasn't councils who ran the cemeteries. Families had their own burial grounds. They'd have a part of their property, their land, that would be set aside for burying their family. And Abram and Sarah don't even own that. Now, most of chapter 23 is taken up with the details of the purchase of this burial plot. I don't know what you thought when it was being read, but it's kind of a strange story, isn't it? There's this kind of Middle Eastern haggling over the block of land, negotiating the price. It seems quite strange that we're given all of this information. But what's happening here is very significant. See, this episode shows us Abraham's faith. You might not have noticed it at first, but that's what it's pointing out to us. So it shows Abraham's complete trust that God will be the one who gives him the land. Just after Abraham has said that he'll buy the land, or that he wants to buy the land, look at it in verse 5, this is what we read. The Hittites replied to Abraham, "Sir, listen to us. You're a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will refuse you his tomb for burying your dead." They obviously have great respect for Abraham. They see him as a mighty prince, and they're saying, "You are very welcome to use any of our burial plots. You choose whichever one you'd like and you can bury your family there." All he has to do is pick where he'd like to bury them. I mean, it's an incredibly generous gesture on the part of the Hittites. And Abraham is appreciative of the generosity, I'm sure, but he insists on buying his own burial plot. And look at the discussion. Pick it up there in verse number 7. Then Abraham rose and bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites. We're told that they're the Hittites about 7 or 8 times, just in case you forgot somewhere through the chapter. It's the Hittites that we're dealing with here. And he said to them, "If you are willing, let me bury my dead. If you are willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, son of Zohar, on my behalf, so that he will sell me the cave of Machpelah, which belongs to him and is at the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site among you." Abram insists that he wants to pay for this. He's appreciative of the gift. The way that he's bowed down before the people shows that he actually respects them and shows that he is appreciative of what they're offering, but he insists that he wants to buy it. And then jump down to verse 14. Ephron said to Abraham, "Listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver, but what's that between you, me and you? Bury your dead." It's interesting that he mentions the price that he would be looking for, say, if there was to be a transaction on this block of ground. And apparently it's a rather hefty price that's being asked for this block of land. Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms and weighed out for him the price that he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weight current among the merchants. So why all this detail? Why all this fuss about this block of land? Why didn't Abraham just say, "Thank you so much for your kind offer. This is where I'd like to bury my family"? Well, again, Abraham knows that he will receive this land as a gift, but not from the Hittites. It will be God who gives him the land. That's what God has promised. And the burial site and the whole of the land of Canaan will be given to Abraham. He's completely convinced of what God has promised. When the land finally comes to him, it won't be because Ephron the Hittite has given it to him. Ephron won't be able to say, "Oh yeah, I gave Abraham his start. I gave him his first piece of land in this area." Back in chapter 14, Abraham rescued the people from Sodom who'd been kidnapped and brought them back to the king of Sodom. And the king of Sodom said, "Look, you can keep everything that they've brought back with them. We just want the people back. You can have everything else." And this is what Abraham said to him. And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, "I have raised my hand to the Lord, the God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and have taken an oath that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the thong of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, 'I made Abraham rich.'" Now, don't misunderstand what he's saying here. This isn't pride on Abraham's part. This is his complete trust that God will be the one who makes him rich. And Abraham doesn't want there to be any confusion about who it is that's made Abraham rich. He doesn't want the king of Sodom saying, "Oh yeah, I gave him his first $100,000 and then he seemed to go on with it quite well after that." And he doesn't want Ephron the Hittite saying, "Yeah, he owns the whole land of Canaan now, but I gave him the first piece of land that he had." Abraham is convinced that God will do it. The man that we saw who wavered in his faith earlier in these chapters. The man who passed off his wife as his sister twice just to save his own skin. Well, he's now completely convinced of the promises of God, isn't he? And making all of his decisions based on them. Well, hot on the heels of that, we see wedding plans being made. Chapter 24 starts with these words, and it's interesting to hear what the writer says. Abram was now old and well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed him in every way. Now, isn't your first thought, hang on, we've just had to haggle over a small block of land because the promise about the land hasn't been fulfilled yet. Is that really true? That the Lord has blessed him in every way? Well, the writer seems to think so. And I've got a funny feeling that Abraham would agree. See, Abraham knows that it's been God who's been protecting him through these last 60-odd years. It's God who's made him wealthy. It's God who's given him a son. It's God who hasn't wavered from the promises that he's made. He's continually repeated the same promises to Abraham. They may look a little slow in being fulfilled, but Abraham's still convinced that God will do it. So now it's time to find a wife for his son. Abram's going to ensure that the promises are going to shape this decision as well. Chapter 24 is a lengthy little account of how they find a wife for Isaac. But look at what Abraham says to his chief servant who he's sending off to find a wife. Starting in verse number 2 of chapter 24. He said to the chief servant of his household, the one in charge of all that he had, "Put your hand under my thigh. I want you to swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from among the Canaanites, among whom I am living, but will go to my country and my own relatives and get a wife for my son Isaac." The servant is sent out with two very clear instructions. The first one is he's not to marry a Canaanite. And the second one, a little further down, is that Isaac has to stay in Canaan. Isaac is to not go and find his own wife. He has to stay in the land. I'm sure you could probably tell stories about difficult engagements and difficult marriage proposals. Prospective son-in-laws or prospective in-laws who are a little fussy. I had a friend who was dating a girl, and they went to see her parents to announce that they were going to get married. And when they told the mother and father of the soon-to-be bride that they were going to marry, the mother stood up and said, "Over my dead body," and walked out of the room. I'm pretty certain that the guy would have been happy to have obliged in that one, but they didn't need to in the end. I had a friend who was dating a Chinese girl, and they were dating without their father's permission. It came time, they decided that they were going to get married, so it was time to confront the father and talk to him about their marriage plans. He didn't take it well. He chased the young man out of the house with a meat cleaver. I'm not sure whether or not he would have attacked him, but he was quite suspicious that that was going to be the case. Parents can sometimes be picky about who it is that their children marry. That's not what we're seeing here. Don't misunderstand the bit about not marrying a Canaanite. You've got to make sure that you understand this is not a racist thing. This is all about the promises that God has made. The whole thing about Isaac not returning to Haran, that he has to stay in the land, that's the thing that really confirms it. Marriage back in those days involved property rights. Marriage back in those days involved alliances between families, building new tribes. When it comes to marrying, Isaac is not going to marry into some wealthy landed family there in Canaan. In fact, marrying a Canaanite woman would only complicate matters. If Isaac were to marry a Canaanite woman, then the Canaanites would have an ongoing claim to the land that Isaac is going to inherit. Abraham's not going to risk the promises by intermarrying with the soon-to-be former owners of the land. So Abram sends his servant back to Haran, where a wife will be found from among Abraham's own people. And what we see in chapter 24, it's not quite your classic Mills and Boone love story, but it's a beautiful story, incredibly well told, And it shows that God's hand is in all of this. The servant knows that God's the one who's got it under control. Rebecca and her family both know that it's God who's got this under control. Time doesn't permit now for us to have a look through the story, but can I encourage you to read it this afternoon? Isaac and Rebecca marry. Abraham is faithful to the promises that God has made. Well, then we come to the final episode, chapter 25. Abram is drawing towards the end of his life. We've now been living in the land for 100 years. And still the only piece of the land that he owns is the plot that he bought from Ephron. We read in this final chapter that Abraham now has a number of children with three different wives. Sarah has given him Isaac. Hagar has given him Ishmael. And a third wife, presumably after Sarah has died, has given him 6 more sons. But look at what we're told. Have a look in verses 5 and 6. Abram left everything he owned to Isaac. But while he was still living, he gave gifts to his son, to the sons of his concubines, and sent them away from his son Isaac to the land of the east. Abram knows that there will be one heir, one inheritor of the promises. God's already made it abundantly clear that will be Isaac. Not Ishmael, not another child, it will be Isaac who will inherit these promises. And Abram doesn't want the issues here to be clouded. He's generous to the other children. It's not as if he's fobbing them off and getting rid of them. He's generous to those other children, and he sends them back to Haran, to the east, where the family had originally come from. They will have no claim on the land. Abram is again acting in light of the promises that God has made. I think one of the really encouraging things when you read through the Abram story is that he actually gets more faithful the older he gets. His faith doesn't become of less importance to him. It doesn't become a kind of little sideline in his life. His faith shapes all of the decisions that he makes. He's more conscious, more and more conscious of acting in light of the promises that God has made. Can you imagine what it would have been like to have been in Abram's shoes? God promised him land. 100 years ago, God promised him land. But he has to buy the only piece that he owns. God promised him descendants as numerous as the sands on the seashore. And he has Isaac, through whom the promises will be carried on. You could forgive Abraham for maybe feeling a little bit cynical about the promises the older he got, for feeling a little bit hard done by with God. You'd understand that even if he wanted to just forget about the promises. I mean, he's been waiting for 100 years, for goodness sake. Or if he just sort of pushed the promises aside a little and kind of got on with his life. I mean, why not just accept the block of land from Ephron? He's wanting to give it to you. Why bother paying for it when the guy says you can have it for nothing? And why not just find a wife from among the Canaanites? I'm sure there would have been some lovely Canaanite girls that Isaac could have married. And why not let the children remain? I mean, surely they can sort that out themselves later on. The older Abraham gets, the more committed he is to shaping his life around the promises that God has made. So there's the challenge, isn't it? Is your confidence in God growing as you get older? Are you more convinced now of the promises that God has made to you than you were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Are you shaping your life more and more around the promises that God has made? I mean, God's made very clear promises to us, just as he's made to Abraham. He's promised us that Jesus will return. He's promised us that when Jesus comes, he will judge this world. He's promised us eternal life. He's promised to take us to be with him for all eternity. They're the promises that should be shaping our lives. They're the promises that should be influencing even the most basic decisions that we make in our life. They should influence our marriage plans. They should influence the shape of our funeral arrangements. They should influence the details of your will, just as it did with Abraham in these stories. It should influence how you live your life. It should influence how you handle your money. It should influence how you face your death. Like Abraham, it should mean that as you face those decisions in your life, you think about the promises that God has made. What influence should those promises have on the decisions that I now make? What influence should my relationship with God have on the choices that I make in my life? That's the lesson from Abraham. And that's the lesson that we need to learn. That more and more our decisions should be based on the promises that God has made, on the relationship that we have with him. Let's pray.